It's from Luke 24:25-35. He said to them, "How foolish you are, and how slow to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Messiah have to suffer these things and then enter his glory?" And beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself. As they approached the village to which they were going, Jesus continued on, as if he were going further. But they urged him strongly, "Stay with us, for it is nearly evening. The day is almost over." So he went in to stay with them. When he was at the table with them, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and began to give it to them. Then their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he disappeared from their sight. They asked each other, "Were not our hearts burning within us while he talked with us on that road and opened the scriptures to us?" They got up and returned at once to Jerusalem. There they found the 11 and those with them assembled together and saying, "It is true, the Lord has risen and has appeared to Simon." Then the two told what had happened on the way and how Jesus was recognized by them when he broke the bread.
I don't have many memories of my childhood. I kind of live in the present, so the past is kind of like a blur for me. But I do have one particular memory that I want to share with you. I was about 9 years old, and every Saturday in the summer season, my dad would get home from work about midday, because they worked Saturday mornings in those days. And showing back a bit, you'll gather. And Mum would pack a packed tea, and we'd go down and we'd watch the cricket. Rochdale, which is where I come from, played in the Central Lancashire League, and it was a really good league. And we'd go and spend Saturday afternoon, early evening, watching these matches in Rochdale. And it was fantastic. I loved it. I really enjoyed it. My dad came in one day and said he had tickets for a test match at Old Trafford in Manchester. And England were playing, I think it was Australia, but I can't remember who we were playing, but it was certainly England playing somebody. And I was so excited. I was 9 years old and so excited. I just couldn't sleep. You know what I mean? We were going to see a test match. I mean, we never went to see a test match, you know, and he got the tickets. So come the morning of the day we were going, I couldn't sleep. I was up early but it was overcast. Now, Rochdale's always overcast. The sun don't shine in Rochdale. Do you know what I mean? So that wasn't really a surprise. It didn't really put me off. But anyway, Mum had made a packed lunch, and so the four of us, my brother and myself and Mum and Dad, got a bus into Manchester, 50 minutes on the bus into Manchester, and a taxi from Manchester, Piccadilly, out to Old Trafford. The trouble was, as we went up the summit from Rochdale to Royton, it didn't just be overcast, it started raining. And it rained buckets. I mean, the bus couldn't see where it was going, it was raining so hard. But we got into Manchester and I was so, you know, Dad wanted to go home. I said, "No, got to go to Old Trafford. No, they'll be playing." I mean, would they be playing? It was pouring down. But we got the taxi and we went to Old Trafford and there was nobody there. Nobody. It was empty. The car park was empty. No one was around. And there was a notice pinned on the door and it said, "Play abandoned for the day." And it was only kind of 10:45. They hadn't even started till 11. And I thought, how dare they abandon this before it's 11 o'clock even? Anyway, that was it. And it was sheeting down. So we got a taxi back to Piccadilly. And we got a bus back to Rochdale. And we had our packed lunch sitting at home with the rain going. And I've got to tell you, I was distraught. I had the worst day of my life. My parents, I must have been miserable. My parents didn't want to do with me. I was so upset. I was so disappointed. And I tell you, from a guy who doesn't have memories of his childhood, it stands out. Do you know what I mean? It's there and it's real. Well, we've heard about the resurrection this morning, and this is a resurrection narrative. But instead of coming out from the point of Jesus, I want to come out from the point of the two disciples. Because they were disappointed people. And I want you to enter into their disappointment and understand why they were so disappointed. And if you want a verse to hook it onto, which isn't really kind of a verse for the resurrection, it's this. Thanks, John. Proverbs 13:12 says, "Hope deferred makes the heart sick." And my heart was sick that day. And the disciples' hearts were sick on the Emmaus Road. But we're going to look at the context for a minute. So here we go. Here's the context. It's the first resurrection appearance of Jesus in Luke's account. Up to this point, Jesus has not actually appeared. They've heard about it, the resurrection, but he hadn't appeared. This is the first one. Not only that, it's unique to Luke. You won't find this in any other three accounts of Jesus' life. The advantage we have is we are onlookers into something. We know what's happening, and they don't. These two disciples don't know. We know that Jesus is alive, and we know that Jesus is walking with them, and they didn't. They had no idea. So, just to let you know, the Emmaus location, oh, you love this one. You love it and hate this little point. But the Emmaus location is uncertain. We really don't know. No one seems to know where it is. In the original translation, the distances were in stadia, and a stadia is 600 feet or something, or 607 feet. But there's a little bit of a dispute in the different ways it's translated, so how far it is. Some say it's 60, which makes it about 6.8 miles, about 7 miles. Some make it 160, which make it nearly 20 miles, right? You can take your pick. I know what I think. I think it's 7. I'll tell you why, because they went back the same day. 20 miles one way and 20 miles the other is a long way to be walking. 7 miles one way and 7 miles the other is a bit simpler. But there you go, because you'll find it say 7 miles in your Bible, probably, but there's this little note that shows a caution at the bottom, just to let you know, okay? It's actually irrelevant to the problem. But here we go. Here we go. Thanks, John. So we come to a hope deferred. And it says in verse 14... that these two disciples were talking to each other on the road. Now, we know that Cleopas was one of them. We have his name. We don't know the other. I think it's his wife. I think Cleopas is walking home with his wife. Because when they get to Emmaus, wherever Emmaus is, when they get to Emmaus, they invite Jesus into their home and they have a meal together. So, I think it's fair comment. You don't have to believe that. That's just my thought. Okay? Anyway, they're walking down the road and they're having this discussion. They're not talking. They're having an intense conversation. This has real feeling to it. They are really, really going with this. This has emotion in it. This is not, how's the weather today? Oh, it's raining in Rochdale. It's raining in Manchester. This is about something has happened and they are really upset about it. So it's a little bit of a British understatement to say they were talking. It means a strong debate, an intense conversation. Well, what had happened? What are they talking about? They're talking about Jesus. They talk about the fact that Jesus, their leader, the one they followed, their teacher, he'd been arrested, he'd been given a false trial, he'd been flogged, and he'd been crucified, and he was dead. That's what they were talking about. The impact of Jesus' death on his disciples must have been profound. They had followed him. This man was really important to them. Their future was tied up with him. And he'd been killed. So this discussion is very profound. And it's quite, not heated, but it's difficult. So Jesus comes up and he stands alongside them and he asks this question. What are you discussing? What are you talking about? And I love I love Luke's honesty. You know how in the beginning of Luke's account of Jesus, it says he had made a very careful investigation. Do you remember that? It says in Luke 1:1, careful investigation, very accurate investigation about what happened with Jesus. Well, here you have a good illustration, because he must have talked to Cleopas. Luke had to have talked to Cleopas, or his wife, or whoever the second person was, because it says they stood still. You know what it's like, don't you? You're walking down the road with someone, and they say something which is really off the wall, and you stop. Well, it says they stood still, puzzled and amazed. And it just shows the reality, the honesty, the integrity of the text, but also of the two disciples. They were really taken aback that somebody could have been walking the same direction as them from Jerusalem and not known what was happening and what happened over the weekend. So they say, you know, are you the only one who doesn't know? I mean, what planet are you on? Well, of course he knew. It had happened to him. But they didn't know that, because they didn't recognize him. So you have this wonderful thing. So Jesus says, well, what things are those? Thanks, John. And then you have this little phrase in verse 21. And this is the point I was trying to get at with a story about the cricket in Old Trafford. But we had hoped. Four words. How profound are those? See, these disciples had an expectation that had been absolutely destroyed. They were just distraught. We had hoped, they said to Jesus. And they went on to say, well, it's about Jesus of Nazareth. He was a prophet in words and actions, faithful to God and the people, the Redeemer of Israel. He was executed by the Romans at the request of the religious leaders. Today, the body's missing. Rumours that he's alive, but, well, no one's seen him. And they pour it out to this stranger, because he's been inside for 2 days now. And somebody asked the question, what things? So they say it. And out it comes. All the disappointment and all the misunderstanding that was theirs. This is really, really quite emotional, you know. This is not kind of some debate on television. This is really heart here. There's something coming from here that says it's all gone wrong. Thanks. So why should it have gone wrong? I think there are two reasons. One is their history. These two disciples were Jewish. They were born in Israel. They'd been brought up in Israel. But for 600 years, this nation had been subjected to other nations. It started with Babylon. And then the Persians conquered the Babylonians and hence took Israel into their nation, into their empire. Then the Greeks came along and clobbered the Persians and took Israel into their empire. Then the Romans came along and clobbered the Greeks. And they took Israel into their empire. Nearly 600 years of subjection. And if you wanted a word to hear in Israel's mouth, it was freedom. They wanted freedom. They wanted to be their own people again. Not told what to do. What they ought to pay in taxes. Sounds familiar. No, okay. Here we go. But they've found it years. And as they read the Bible, their Old Testament, the Old Testament for us, their scriptures, they saw everything through the lens of freedom. That's what it was about for them. So it was inconceivable that the Messiah would die and suffer. And it was interesting. He said, we'd hoped. What was their hope? One who was going to redeem Israel. It wasn't a spiritual redemption. It was a physical redemption. It was a physical freedom. Jesus should not have died. He failed to live up to their expectation of Messiah. And it was very hard to cope with, because they had a view that this man, this leader, Messiah, the Christ, would lead them to victory against the Romans, and the Romans had killed him. See where the disappointment comes, can't you? This is not easy, because history has a profound effect on our understanding of who we are and how we view things, how we listen to things. So history is a big thing. So Isaiah 53, well, Psalm 22. On Psalm 22, we read it on Good Friday morning, didn't we? Do you remember that? We read Psalm 22 if you were here. And we referred that to the cross because it describes the cross. No Jew living in Jesus' time would have read Psalm 22 and thought of Messiah. Nobody, they wouldn't have read Isaiah 53, the suffering servant, and thought of Isaiah, thought of Messiah. It was inconceivable to them Messiah would suffer. The Messiah would lead them. And the second one is their world. Well, the contrary to that is disappointment. The second one is a cultural worldview. See, it says, do you remember, it says in the passage, the women didn't find the body. That's what they said to this third party walking with them. The women didn't find the body. Didn't say that Jesus was resurrected. Said that the women didn't find the body. Why? Because resurrection wasn't on their radar. It wasn't on anybody's radar. You didn't think resurrection, because their worldview was Israel, first century. We live now. And you say, well, of course, we live 21st century. So is resurrection on your radar? I mean, you know, does our culture suggest that there's a possible resurrection? No, of course it doesn't. Because we all know that death is the end. Because we live this kind of life, and that's why I get what I can in this life, because actually there's nothing else. Culture will tell me that. We live within the restrictions of our worldview, the parameters of our worldview. And if something comes outside it, we can't cope with it because it doesn't fit. So when the women came back and said, the body's gone, we've met these angels, the conclusion is they've taken the body. The body's missing. And that's what they said to Jesus. The women didn't find the body. The thing is that the resurrection, it just shatters the parameters of our worldview. And you say, well, it wouldn't be on their radar, would it? But actually, it should have been. It really should have been. Because 2,000 years before, the forefather of the nation, Abraham, in Hebrews 11, is it 19 or 18? 19 says that he reasoned that God could raise the dead. That's why he's in Hebrews 11. He's commended by God because he reasoned that God could raise the dead. How do we know that? Well, come back with me. Just as a cul-de-sac. I'm going off a cul-de-sac for a minute. In Genesis, you have this little account of Abraham with Isaac, the son. You remember that God had promised Abraham that he'd be the father of many nations, and God would bless the nations through him, through his offspring. And Isaac is born, who's the son of promise. And then God says, sacrifice your son. And they came to the base of the mountain. They have a servant with them. And they come to the base of the mountain. And the servant says, "When will you, you know, where are you going?" He said, "Don't worry. You stay here. My son and I will return. We'll return." But he's just going to sacrifice him in obedience to God. And he tells the servant, "We'll return." So where's the logic in that? Well, the logic is this. If God has promised him to be the father of many nations through his offspring, and Isaac is the son of promise, then if he kills his son, God has to raise him from the dead. Has to. Otherwise, he's not God of the covenant. He's not God of the promise. So his understanding of God was, God can raise the dead. He has to be able to do that. Otherwise, he can't fulfill his promise to me about the nations. So actually, resurrection was part of the thinking. It was there. It's just the culture is so strong that they just could not get the idea that Jesus could be raised from the dead. And it is a most significant part. It's just interesting, really. Thanks. So here we go. We're on to a halt, refocus, verses 25 to 27. So Jesus addresses their disappointment and misunderstanding. And he's very blunt with them, because he says, you know, the Messiah had to suffer and then comes glory. He's not exactly, I don't know how you feel about Jesus sometimes, but, you know, he can be very hard. I mean, these two guys are walking down the road and they just pour their heart out to him because they're disappointed and they've misunderstood. You know, they just are so upset and grieving. And Jesus says, foolish and slow to believe. And you think, where's the arm around the shoulder? Where's the encouraging word? Jesus is very blunt with them. Why would he be that? Well, because he'd already spent about 6 months before telling his disciples he was going to suffer and die, and they hadn't listened. Actually, they'd listened, they just wouldn't accept it. They didn't understand it, and at one point, they even rebuked Jesus for saying it. So it was way above where they're at. And Jesus says, slow of heart to believe. And he starts to talk to them about it, and he says how the Messiah had to suffer before going to his glory. And he links suffering with glory. Because what they wanted, what the disciples wanted, was the glory. We know that because James and John wanted to sit one on Jesus' right, one on his left, when he sat next to the Father in heaven. We had discussions about who's the greatest among us. 3 times they had the discussion. So they wanted the glory, but they didn't want the suffering. Jesus said, you don't get the glory without the suffering. And he says it very clearly. So you have Isaiah 53, the suffering servant chapter. After the suffering of his soul, he will see the light of life and be satisfied. We've just done Romans 8, haven't we, a couple of weeks ago. Do you remember that? I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. 2 Corinthians 4:16, our light and momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that far outweighs them. Philippians 2, Jesus became obedient unto death, even the death on the cross. Therefore God exalted him to the highest place. There is no glory without suffering. And Jesus began to address their misunderstanding, their disappointment. And he began to help them understand something that was going to change, I think, change their life very quickly. Here we go. Thank you. So he taught, I mean, we don't have time to do this, you know. This is just, what is it, 4 illustrations? This is Jesus in the Old Testament, because he said, starting with Moses and all the prophets, he interpreted them in all the scriptures, the things concerning himself. So here you go. Deuteronomy is Moses. It's the law of Moses, first 5 books of the Bible. God will raise another prophet like Moses, a leader and a deliverer. It's talking about Messiah. Isaiah 35, Messiah will speak in parables. Isaiah 49:6 is about the most profound verse in terms of the Great Commission you can ever get, where the Father talks with the Son about the task of the Son to reach the nations with salvation. And the Gentiles are included in Isaiah 49, which is quite fortunate because most of us are Gentiles. So Zechariah 12:10, that Messiah will be pierced and the people mourn. This is one of those conversations. Wouldn't you just have loved to be a listening, you know, just to listen to what Jesus said? He just gave them a survey of the Old Testament about himself. I was going to say a fly on the wall, but they're outdoors walking on a road. So, I mean, you know, join. Just kind of, if you could just have stood alongside and walked and just listened in, it would have been an amazing conversation to hear. And so they get to Emmaus. Thank you. And now the hope is being refocused. The invitation to stay is getting toward the end of the day. This says, have a meal. And then it says, when he was at the table with them, in, this is verse 30, he took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and to give it to them. If you go to Mark 14:22, it's almost the same verse, speaking of the Last Supper. And it says, Jesus took bread, gave thanks, broke it, and gave to his disciples three nights before. And people say, well, of course, it's the breaking of bread that did it. Because he actually says that in the last verse of our reading, verse 35. We see, I don't think it was the meal. I'm not sure it was. Because Cleopas wasn't there. Cleopas was not one of the 12. He was one of the many people that followed Jesus, as well as the 12. And the Passover, Jesus celebrates with the 12. I don't think it's that. I think what it is as Jesus took the bread, it could have been the first time they ever saw his hands. Because he could have walked, you know, they had robes, you know, and he went in. But as he went for the bread and broke it and offered it to them, what would they see? They see the nail prints. And it all fell into place. Everything he said on the road, what the women said about not finding the body, suddenly they see it. I think it's in the nail prints. Because the nail prints are in heaven today. They're still in the hands of Jesus. And he went. Disappeared. Just as he went, the guests disappeared. Thanks. Their response? Well, it says their hearts, did not our hearts burn within us while he walked with us on the way and opened up the scriptures to us? That was their great hindsight is a great thing. Self-awareness after the event is wonderful. And they just realized what was happening to them on this walk to Emmaus. And it says their hearts were warmed. Burnt. They just had an emotional response to this man that walked with them and all that he was saying to them. And he's not on his own. This is John Wesley. You know John Wesley, don't you? He's, you know, this, the Methodist guy. I was a Methodist, so I can't say that, can I? He was, anyway, 18th century. Here we go. He listened. Just get this. He didn't have Romans read to him. He had Luther's preface to Romans read to him. Get that. Aren't you pleased we're studying Romans? Anyway, so he said, and he writes after, he said, about 9:15, while this reader was describing the change which God works in the heart through faith in Christ, I felt my heart strangely warmed. I felt I did trust in Christ, Christ alone for salvation, and an assurance would give me that he'd taken away my sins, even mine, and saved me from the law of sin and death. This is a response of these two followers of Jesus to understanding who he is, what has happened to him, and this is wonderful. So they get up and they go back to Jerusalem. That's why I think it's 7 miles, not 20. Generally, because they go back and they go to the upper room, presumably, or wherever they're staying, and they say, and before they can get out their words, they're told, it's right, it's true, Jesus is risen. Simon's seen him. It's true. And they say, yeah, actually, we've just had this amazing conversation with him. So it kind of changed their life from here on out. Things are different now. Thanks. So what do we learn? Well, the first thing we learn is the worldview. Jesus is alive. There are people who had no prior understanding of the resurrection. When they met Jesus, everything changed. I wonder if your worldview includes the possibility of resurrection. Includes the possibility of eternity. That life is not limited to the point of death, but goes straight. I love the story about this morning, Phil, about the little girl who went shopping across the road through the cemetery. If you weren't here, just well, I've just mentioned, they were going through, this little girl lived on a house, in a house, went to a shop across the road, through a cemetery. And somebody said to her, "Aren't you afraid?" And she said, "No, because I see the light of my home. When the light's on, I just walk toward my home and it's fine. The cemetery doesn't worry me." That's a fantastic illustration of a worldview that accepts and understands something beyond the bounds of physical life, of taste and touch and smell and sight and hearing. This goes way beyond. How small is your worldview? And are you willing to even consider that there is something which will take you out of your comfort zone, out of these small parameters of your understanding, to something that can change your life? Worldview is really quite significant. But then history. There was an unfulfilled expectation of Jesus in what he will do for us. And if you have an expectation of Jesus like that, it will rob you of hope. You will be disappointed. You cannot shape Jesus to be a comfortable Jesus that you want him to be. You cannot do that. Do it at your peril. Because Jesus isn't boxed like that. Far from it. You can't say, you know, we had hoped. What did they hope for? A redeemer who'd free Israel. What was Jesus thinking about? A redeemer who would free all the nations to know God the Father. How small is their view? How small is their understanding of these things? Jesus did not meet my expectation. Is not a good comment to make. That's not the model that you need to follow. We need to follow a model that allows Jesus to be the Jesus of the Bible. And allow Jesus of the Bible and who he is to make his promises to us. And that will energize us. You form a Jesus in your own shape and model around yourself to be comfortable with. It will kill any sense of hope. Because he will always disappoint you. This Jesus will always disappoint you. But the Jesus of the Bible, the Jesus who makes promises based on who he is, his life, well, his incarnation, life, death and resurrection, will never, never let you down. He will always walk with you. That's one of the wonderful things, isn't it? I mean, it's a bit trite saying, but Jesus walked with the two disciples through Emmaus, but he says he'll always walk with us forever. I will never leave you, said Jesus. There's hope. That's hope. There is nowhere that we can go in this world at any point, at any time, in any circumstance, that Jesus cannot go with us. Now there's hope. That's genuine hope, based on the Jesus of the Bible. So here's a final question. Just to leave this with you. When was the last time that your heart was warmed when you read about Jesus? Now there's a thought, isn't it? When's the last time you read the Gospels? You know, the different accounts of Jesus' life. And as you read it, your heart warmed to him. Burned, almost, to him. And you kind of just felt a thrill at being in the presence of a man like Jesus, who is God. And perhaps if it's got a bit too familiar for you, and you've read the gospel so much, you know, you know him backwards, start again. Start reading it again. And ask the question the disciples asked when they're in the boat and Jesus stilled the storm. And their question was, who is this man? Who is this man? It's a great question to ask when you read the four accounts of Jesus' life.